Thank you for turning in Creepypasta's Home in the Dark. I will be reading from 101 Terrifying Tales, Great Ghost Stories, collected by Stephen. I'm not going to pronounce his last name because I don't know how to, and I'm going to butcher it horribly. Hope you enjoy.
Earth Souls Day
by D.K. Broadster. The Saint's Breviary, we are told, at the church was kept at the Priebersten by M. Lee Kier, would be delighted to show it to us. So we went thinner. And passing under the archway in the wall and through a tiny garden corner bright with flowers, found that M. Lee Kier was out but was expected back at any moment. And we were requested to wait at the parlor. This we were glad enough to do, for Brenton roads in August are hot and dusty. We were somewhat weary of our long walk. The parlor was rather dark and very cold. It had strange black chairs arranged with extreme precision along the walls, a round table in the middle, and was hung with a few scarred prints. At either end of the mantelpiece, under a glass shade, was a little crucifix and of extremely uncouth worshipman. The cure was not appearing. I was wandering aimlessly around the room when my eyes fell upon a book which we had come to see. It in a roughly made case on a table in the window. "Here's our quarry," I exclaimed. "I wonder why the housekeeper didn't tell us that it was in here." A card neatly written gave us information as to the date and authenticity of a brewery, but we did not like to take the volume from its case to examine more closely until the guardian should arrive. Our host has one or two good buildings up there, remarked by my friend. His eyes traveled to a little bookcase upon the wall. "Moreover, if that's not in English 17th century tooling, I'll eat my hat." Moved by the scared enthusiasm of the Bible office, he stretched up a hand and plucked the book forth. "Look," he said, "in a Dutch printed Latin copy, the Imitation of Christ of the year 1620. I thought I know a little of bindings. I saw the signification in the faded inscription on the flyleaf. Mild May Fane, presumed the owner's name, was written high on the right-hand corner of the lower down, and eventually at a different time, Hukin Liburn and L.R.E. de V. Debit Anna M.D.C.X.X.I. in memorial massacrefin non obliviscondo and lower down again, ora pro anima ansi, by joy. I said, given by the Englishman and a Frenchman in 1631, I wonder what is it doing here, and who ansi was. But I was spooked by the door opening, and the cure hurried in, full of gentle apologies for keeping us waiting. He was the most beautiful and fragile man that I had ever been my lot to meet. He had spoken a few words before we knew that he had a mind to match his person. In a minute or so, the saint's bravery was out of its case, and we were examining it with attention, while the priest discouraged of it in a manner that showed he had no small knowledge of medieval manuscripts. It seemed to be all that was claimed for it, while its guardian's pride in it, and the manufist's pleasure it showed to be foreigners, of whom one of the least of the complete critic. We were delighted to witness, but the discussion became at the end of two technological for my attention. We wandered off to musingly until I realized that the examination of the breviary was finished. You are very able, Monsieur, to have come this far to see this relic, remarked the cure, pulled his spectacles lower on his nose and looked at us over then. Especially as you are, I suppose, potences, he added, my friends and I disclaimed the title so hastily it caused the old priest some amusement. Well, well, he said indulgently, at any rate, you cannot have known the same devotion of the blessing hue which brought here most of those who come to see this book. But there is one saint in his book, I observed rather sententiously, I fear, for whom we all have a like devotion, whatever our country, greed, or age, and holler out the imagination. I asked him if he knew if he would be good enough to satisfy our curiosity about it. Oh, there you have a great treasure of mind, he said, smiling. It had been as a heirloom to my family, Monsieur, a bargain. If you stay and take dejeuner with an old man who has not often the pleasure of meeting an Englishman, I will tell you the story of our countrymen and the inscription in his acapus. We are the heart only to pleasure to stay, and so I fancied that the housekeeper was not to so pleasure, and I heard a vociferations from the kitchen. We all had an excellent little dejeuner. The old priest was so charmed and fixtured of Chardus and navette of family and knowledge of the world that he conversated the holy delight delightful. After the meal, we went into the little walled garden, and sat under a pear tree where our coffee was brought to us. After we assisted the cure to haunt a fowl out of his bed of seedling wallflowers, I think the blessed Saint Francis must have omitted to preach on the base cure, he said ruefully as we came back. For my part, I often feel most unchristian to my sister, the hen. When we had finished our coffee, we drew the book out of the pocket of its cassock. I must warn you that this is a story of the fireside in the winter, and not for all this. He waved his hand and included all the little green garden and warmed the fragrant air and stalked wallflowers, flangling and trifling the sun and the drowsy cooling from the unset dovecot. But it does not matter. This book then was given to a member of the family, but its owner, Mr. Fane, an English gentleman of great gifts, both of mind and body, a very noble person, un homme de lettres, as we say. All those qualities are like to suffer ruin through a disaster which befell him in early manhood. This calamity brought through the no fault of his own plunge him into circumstances which were leading him into a direction very different from the path wherein he had early set up, into which the mercenary of God he afterwards returned, though the strange alliance you shall hear about at the end of the year 1629. Mr. Fane, a little more than 30 years of age, was visiting Paris on his return from a foreign tour when he had a misfortune to incur the enmity of a certain Clavier de Carson, a man of notional evil life. They had met but a few times, with a violent quarrel took place between them, in which Mr. Fane, so far as human judgment goes, had undoubtedly right upon his side. As a result of this disagreement, Mr. Fane held himself in readiness to receive a challenge from the Chevalier. The expected cardinal was never sent, but M. de Crosol took other means to avenge himself. As the Englishman returned alone one night from a ball, he was sent upon by the cleaver and several of his lackeys, who had the brief struggle left him for dead in the street. The door which Mr. Fane fell with half a score of wounds upon him was that the house of Dr. L. Egerto, the Grand Duke of P., was making his residence during the private sonneur in Paris. The great duke's domestic, then Mr. Fane, was found in the early morning by, and being carried within, was was there carried for during the space of 2 or 3 months, for many weeks of his time of this time of life, was despair of and he was unable to give an account for himself. However, the Grand Duke, seeing that he had to do with a gentleman of unconditional, whose appearance moreover had from the first attract him, sparing nothing of the hospitality and care, it so changed that Mr. Fane had dispatched his servants to England before he entered Paris, and that none of his acquaintances in the city were aware of his presence, nor the inconsequence of the disaster had befallen him. There was no person, therefore, to make inquiries concerning him, nor to reveal his identity, which he was lying for weeks unconscious, was equally unable to disclose. The result of this gentle ignorance, when he returned at last to scene in life, was not long reaching Mr. Fane's ear. His friends in England and abroad alike believed him dead, slipped out of his life by some such door, perhaps as that though which he had so nearly passed. And in England, the lady whom he had hopes of winning was married to another. Mr. Fane now fell into a great despair of blackness of soul. So much did he feel the faithfulness of her whom a few short months' silence could so alter that the idea of returning to England was so abhorrent to him, nor to his disordered mind, did not appear to signify that he had, after all, escaped the sword of his enemy, pursued himself, that his friends had forgotten him, and when the Grand Duke, who had convinced a violent attachment of his company, implored him to return with him to Italy, Mr. Fane consented with a sort of indifferent pleasure, saying brittily that a dead man had no right to come to life again. He accordingly left Paris in the train of Grand Duke. Dead he was, and in another and more real sense, not indeed so dead as the majority of those with whom he concerned, but with scarcely a trace of remaining of that interior life which had once been to him the only existence worthy of the name Carl Elgido, the Prince of Cultured Vices, called him say a recluse, and strove to to draw him more admittedly to a circle of his own pleasures, but that Mr. Fane was of a different fashion from most of the Grand Duclair's associated, did not, after all, confer on him any real title to those names. Yet the pleasure of the court held little savior for him, and sometimes, on his knees with the others, all that superstition masked with all the attention for Carlo Elgado was extremely orthodox. Faint and bitter memories of better days broken into his soul, and the shy little Grand Duchess Marina Maldada, the poor little bride who regretted he convected talking to him at times of themes which had once been more than the name to him, in which these conversations could not but know it, were almost all she had to prevent their becoming names to her also. It was for her sake that he suffered the mention of things once dear, now inexplicably alien to him, and perhaps a little for her sake, to that he kept himself clean of the grosser forms of vice. But these could not fail in times to close upon him. The ladies in the court were none too difficult, in that he had every gift to commend him to a woman. Before the winter had come, Donna Valvena Renazzucchi, a married kingswoman of the Duke's, had loyed him among the perilous path of inimicy in a direct and a darious end. He did not love her, but she had wrestled him. She had wrestled for him as much as he had all those days to give. To give to any woman, but to a intensity of such a kind that the time of the feeling surrounded in such surroundings there could be but any one conclusive. Mr. Fane, with only fulfilling, alas, what his word expected of a gentleman of fashion, when after the year's resistance of P had made preparations for becoming Donna Flay's acknowledgement lover. It was 10 o'clock on the second evening of November. October, so lately fled, had carried off few leaves from the trees in the Duke's beautiful garden, into which Mr. Fane sat looking from a window seat of his apartment in a place a half moon sometimes obscured by light fingers of cloud shone on this on the statues among the trees. Of dried and fawns, Judads and fawns, in the silence in the middle of the nearest plot. And throughout the opening casement came now and then the shiver of the leaves, half lying in the deep set seat of Englishman propped his chin up on his hand and looked out. Something in the tall cypresses reminded him of a graveyard in the white of a silent statue of monuments or ghosts. Ghosts might well walk on the place gardens. The ghosts of those who had played their lives there on the lawns of the trances in summer or in winter. The apartment on the other place, now all right with the ravenly from which they had withdrawn himself for what? Donna Freyer's letter was in a pocket. In a few years, she too would be a ghost in a garden, but what is already dead, and had a right to walk already. And she remembered what indeed he had forgotten merely for an hour or two. That it was All Souls Day. Even as he remembered it in a heavy window, certain said slowly out from its place as a curtain by an open window will do either of a gust of wind or with an opening of a door, but the window was nothing save an occasional light shudder in the garden, and the door at the end of the long dimly lit road had the truth being open for turning his head on an instant. Mr. Frame heard the softly closed, looking down on the room. He discerned the figure of the man coming towards him and with some vexation wondered his interned announcement at such an hour. But as the intruder came nearer, he stood from a window with his hand on his sword. It was the cliver discusser. He was dressed as always with some elaboration in rich and plain sentations, with the dark love locks falling apart, thence point a jewelry in his ear, and a medal or an order on a broad ribbon about his neck, bareheaded, with his left hand sparkling with rings, resting lightly on his sword hilt, he came slowly down the room toward his foe. And he, in his short velvet coat swung from his shoulder as he walked, but when he was within a couple of yards from Mr. Fane, he suddenly halted and stood looking at him with an air of extraordinary seriousness. Mr. Fane's last recollection of him was very different, and of a wild passion and vindicate triumph which had been imprinted on his consilience. There is now no trace, nor indeed of any other emotions. All expressions seem to have wiped as with a sponge from his face, which yet bore nothing by which a man may recognize one whom he has loved or hated. What do you want here? Asked Mr. Frame, finding his voice at the last under his amazement. The clever made no answer, nor move, but continued to look at him with eyes of strange flickering grayness. Speak in God's name, cried Fane. What are you here for? Are you mad?
And indeed, there could scarcely be any explanation of his audacity. Do you not know, said the clever in a low tone, speaking French, that it is the Dieu de Monts? The sound of his voice carried Dr. Fane back in an instant to the dark streets in Paris, the torches of the swords. I know it, he returned in the same tongue, and you perhaps a fancy to join them. His visitor paid no heed, but continued to look at Mr. Fane with the same unscrambled calm, said gravely, I came to warn you of Pearl, another assassination, exclaimed the Englishman brittily. Rather self-murdered, replied the cleaver, with no faintest sight of bleaching as at a taunt. His composure, but still more the reference of his own private affairs, was too much for Dr. Fane, but now by him that made me. He began springing towards him. The cleaver retreated a step and put out his hand to stay him, but Mr. Fane never touched him. In after years, I believe he could never satisfactorily account for the reason of sudden enlightenment. The figure, even in the subtle light, was so distinct, so real, with all the visible attributes of breathing humanity about it. But the closer advances he knew, he recoiled very slowly, crossing himself almost mechanically, and the dead murderer and his living victim stood looking at each other across the ravine level. There was no fear in Mr. Fane's heart, but all certainly. And the great wonder, why had the creature come to ask for forgiveness? No, for as the thought shot through his mind, he forgotten for a moment that he had already paused between them. The appreciation answered it. I am beyond the reach of human pardon, Mr. Fane, but I entreat you, by him your name is just now, not to do this thing. The strange dead eyes were full upon him, passionless, but yet compelling. Fane was shaken, but it to be brought to book by one whom he could not be known with the infinitely worse than himself, touched his sore and hauntedly soul so sharply, the human passion swept away from the sense, which one might have supposed overpowering, that
he was speaking to a living man. "Enough," he said shortly, and added, "You find yourself surely on a strange errand. M. Latreville, the messenger," returned his visitor almost inaudibly. "If you accounted for you and will not listen, nor stay your steps before it be too late." Mr. Fane, without replying in words, made a gesture of negation, and a clock in some recesses of the door struck the quarter. It was the hour at which he had ordered his chair to await him. The figure in his vicinity stood between him and the door through which he must pass to gain the courtyard. Not that door at the end of the room by which the Clavier had entered, but the Porte de Legate on the left of the window. He looked toward impatiently in the way that would be plain to an earthly guest. Mr. Fane said he figured holding his hand while for the first time of a trace, for emotional thrilled in his low and even voice, "Mr. Fane, I will call another to stay you. You shall not dare to pass that door." And with that, he returned on his heel, and naturally as a living man might turn on the wall. Not far from the door, there hung a beautiful carving crucifix of ivory and silver. Carl got gift to his favorite. Before Fane had time to interpose, the spirit of his enemy had it in his hand, and in his right, he lightingly dull upon it. A little dagger, which he drew from his beast, now he was at the door, and he put the crucifix high up against the central plane panel, and holding it thus, drove the stiletto through the ring deep in the wood. Then a half turn, looked about at Fane, was gone. Midway, Fane wiped the sweat from his forehead. The room was empty, just as it had been a few minutes ago, save for a white Christ hanging over against him, nailed to an oak by an assassin's dagger. The sense of having dealt with the unseen was a thousandfold more potent than when he had spoken to a phantom. Great God, what did it mean? Yet he knew. He told himself that he was dreaming, but the crucifix upon the door, was it real or was it not? He slowly went up to it, not daring to touch it. Yes, surely it was as real as sight could prove it. And the little dagger with the ruby in the hilt, the dagger which he knew, which had once had its own blood upon it, was fast in the panel, and he put out his hand, and he drew it back again. "I will leave the Christ there until I return, and if it be there still, I shall know that I am not dreaming. I am afraid of ghosts," he thought to himself, but he stood for a moment looking fixed at the figure so strangely suspended in his path. The clock struck half an hour, and he turned around to get his cloak from the window seat. When he had his back to the barrel door, he thought with a smile of his own visitor's defiance, "You shall not dare pass that door." He put his cloak about him and walked steadily to it again. Oh God, how the Christ looked at him. Under the thorn crown boughs, and as midway fain stood with his hand upon the handle in the act of the turn the latch, he suddenly drew back trembling, not knowing, but as one dream, he put out his hand in the covert's poignard, and his fingers encounter nothing but the panel on the door, but the crucifix, as though its support were removed, slipped instantly down the polished oak. He caught it as it fell, and as the fingers closed on the symbol, which he incredibly act of divine mercy, he placed to bar his way, had placed to bar its way. The temptation dropped dead in the beasts like a shot bird, and was the overmaster sense of awe and gratitude. He sank upon his knees with the crucifix passed on his lips. A week later, he left P forever. Of all the Grand Duke's gift, he carried away with him but one, and left nothing behind of permanency but his memory to the little Grand Duchess. "So you see, my children," said the old priest, smiling upon us, "that even if on all either of you has such a thing, you should not need to think, but he came to do you harm." "But Father," said I, infinitely touched by the swayness of his tone, "why should it have been his enemy that was sent by Mr. Fane? Do you think it was in expectation of his crime?" The priest shook his head. "That is not for me to say. Let us hope so. I think that when Mr. Fane prayed before the altar to respond to Clever's Saul, that as he did to the end of his life, as he here asked his friend to pray, he lifted the book that must have been a hope with him when he prayed always, as I am sure he did, that he himself, to whom the great mercy had been given, Mercanda no oblivious sandolo sundor, might not be found waiting in the day of the Lord. That was a long story to read. It was well over 30 minutes. And I hope you enjoyed it. I was very confused, so I hope you understood it some. I really didn't understand it, and I didn't understand why it was a scary story.
because I really just didn't understand it. But if you do understand it, well, I guess leave a comment, I guess, and be like, this is what it was about and stuff. So, yeah, hope you enjoyed. Bye.